Chapter 2. Hunter 2, this is 1. Hold up a minute. I'm updating our map trace. Hunter 2, roger. Arm Brewster settled the scout mech into its dismount position, and it dropped to the ground on reverse jointed legs like a nightmare chicken roosting. Almeida stomped off to a flank and started slowly covering a 360-degree arc. Arm Brewster switched on a blackout light, and the cockpit was bathed in a dull red glow as he cracked his knuckles. Skirting the perimeter of the slums had taken a lot longer than anticipated. Civilians kept leaving their houses in groups and had to be corralled back into their homes. Arm Brewster wanted to start firing at them. After all, breaking curfew was an executable offence, but Almeida had talked him down. It was unreasonable, he argued, to gun people down in cold blood simply for being outside. He had said that the rule was a throwback to the Troubles, and now it would be insane to start shooting the place up on a whim. Damn Almeida and his logic. The time they had spent yelling at civilians had meant that they would not meet their return deadline if they kept to the same route, so something had to change. Arm Brewster scrutinized his laminated map board and pulled out a marker. Hunter 2, this is 1. I've changed the route. Over. Arm Brewster paused to give his wingman time to observe his own map board. 1, this is 2. Go on, replied Almeida. Arm Brewster traced the new route as he spoke, keeping one eye on the monitors. I'm switching from route green to route blue. 11, then 13, then 24, then back to green and back in. Roger so far. Almeida repeated the map spots correctly. The army used the spot system for each of its sectors, with every major road junction being assigned a spot, which included a colour and a number. This was for ease of use, as they could go on patrol and simply say, I'm using patrol route green today, for example. Also, if any unit got into contact, all they would have to do is report which spot number they occupied, and the QRF would immediately know where they are. Complex grid references took time to relay, as the user had to figure it out first. It was an elegant system, and had worked well in the past. The reason is we're going to be back late otherwise, and I want to swing by the last gate on the way back. Roger that, mate. Hunter 2 is on the move. Almeida seemed as unconcerned by the route change as he did about anything else. Arm Brewster switched on his long-range HF antenna to report his route change to Sector Command as he took control of his machine and followed his wingman. Static. He tried again, listening intently to the carrier wave as he was rocked gently by the stomping motion of his hunter. Nothing. Maybe the high-rise habitat blocks around them were messing with the signal. Never mind, he thought to himself as the long-range antenna retracted. It's just a quick shortcut, a gate check, and then we'll be back to base. Hunter 2. 1. We've got no comms to command. Hunter 2, roger. We better make sure these heaps don't break down then. Arm Brewster laughed, then stopped abruptly.
Get back inside your building!
He screamed through external speakers to a small huddle of civilians who stood smoking in a doorway. They just ignored him and stared. Damn these people, he thought, and they walked on. What's wrong with this picture? Almeida asked, rhetorically. By the saints. The two scout mechs halted, and Almeida smoothly swung around to cover the way they'd just come. The gate was open. 50 feet high and as wide as the carriageway, the district gate was a nigh impenetrable barrier. It was only open twice a day on shift changes to allow the workers to get to and from the mines. Now wasn't either of those times. We should check the job list. I checked it before we left, Arm Brewster replied, annoyance in his voice. Maybe they changed it. They wouldn't change it without telling us. He didn't like this. Unscheduled gate openings were serious business. Maybe they tried and they couldn't reach us, Almeida pointed out. Would you shut up, please? Arm Brewster bit his lip in thought for a moment. Cover me. I'm going to disembark and check the gate computer. Roger that, boss, Almeida deadpanned. Every district gate had a terminal, about 4 feet high and made of reinforced steel. It was painted matte green, just like everything else owned by the military, and had two doors on the front that were secured by a heavy combination lock. Arm Brewster thumbed the wheels of the lock into the right positions, occasionally glancing about up and down the partially lit roadway. his other hand tightened on the pistol grip of his carbine as a light rain pattered down. He hated being out of his cockpit. Even though his mech was roosting just a few feet behind him, he felt unsafe without its protection. He hated how the breeze felt against his face, how the air carried with it the tang of pollution, as opposed to the scrubbed air inside his Hunter. He shuddered at the minor chill and pulled the lock away from the door, sliding the deadbolt to one side. The computer door swung open to reveal a scratched plexiglass screen with a weatherproofed rubbery keyboard beneath it. "Come on, come on," he muttered as he heard the tubes warm up, and the screen presented him with a familiar red text of the city bulletin board system. He tapped in his access information carefully with one finger, unused to typing with leather gloves on. He hated computers too, didn't trust the things, but these ones were hard-lined in a network that spanned the city. It would allow him to communicate with Sector Command, albeit slowly. Internal workings made screeching noises as he waited an age to be redirected to the military board. He didn't get the chance to reach Sector 78's specific thread. What's in the seven hells? There was just one message, repeated over and again. He scrolled through different sector threads, then district, then even central, which he shouldn't have been able to access. The same message in the old tongue, invoking the spirit of the fighter. Armbruster decided to open the message. "Welcome, Brigador. Here is your contract." Armbruster read it all, carefully, then again to be sure. It was simple logic. The corporation owns hundreds of worlds. The corporation outranks the great leader. Armbruster made his choice. He shut down the terminal and hurried back into his cockpit. As soon as he sealed the top hatch, he reattached his jack and systems came alive. "This is Hunter 2. What took you so long? What did Command say?" Armbruster thought about it and wondered if he should tell his old friend about the contract. "Well?" "Nothing," he replied. "There were no instructions or alterations. This is an unauthorized gate opening." Armbruster looked at the darkness beyond the gate and felt a thrill of excitement shudder through him. This was it. Something big was about to happen. "Well, I suggest we get out of the open and cover that gaping hole in our defenses then," Almeida said impatiently over the net. It made sense, of course. Scout mechs could not take a beating like their heavier counterparts, and use of cover was instrumental to their success in a fight. He was already moving away from the gate, towards the heavily built-up habitation zone, when Armbruster replied. "Of course, lead the way." The civilians watched as they approached, and did not move. "You have the best legs I've ever seen," said Colonel Rome, flashing a smile. Edwina Blake stared at him with intensity. He was sprawled on a chair that he had fashioned from a table and several crates, letting his spotless jacksuit get coated in grime. Was this why he had asked her to meet him privately, and in the wreck yard of all places? She had expected more from him, really. "That isn't a proposition. You can stop looking at me like you want to gouge out my eyes." Her look faltered a bit. His smile did not. "I truly mean it. Your leg units are the best I've seen in all the districts. It was specifically why I left your sector till last on my list of visits." Blake was confused. "Thank you, sir. But how? How could you possibly know what my leg units would be like?" He waved in the air dismissively. "Don't worry about formality when we're out of earshot of the troops, Ed. We're peers. You know we're equals, regardless of rank." Blake appreciated the gesture, but had no time for ambiguity. "Well then, Charles, thank you again. But can we not dawdle? I have a sector to run." He laughed unexpectedly, then replied, "That's exactly what I mean. That right there." He paused, allowing time for his comment to sink in. "I meant what I said earlier. You scored highest out of our intake. I've been watching your career closely these last few years, Edwina." He looked away, another smile threatening to appear, as though he was about to say something dirty. "Do you know what the troops call you?" She did. "Steady Ed." "That's right. And there's a reason for that," Rome went on. Sooner or later, she was sure he would get to the point. "You've never rocked the boat, never missed one quota, never fouled up a patrol, or submitted a report with so much as a typo in it. Edwina was fully aware of her own service record. She was also aware of how unimpressive it was. I've never done anything of note either. Never successfully broken up a food riot without causing thousands of casualties. Well, you know what they say, right place, right time, Rome was saying before Blake cut him off. That's not it at all, sir. Using the mongooses to form a defensive baseline, using smoke launchers to disperse the crowds, making the infantry use their transports to gather wounded and take them to medical stations, all without firing a shot. No commander in the history of Novo Solo has done that before. Blake shook her head as she thought of the correct words.
It was inspired.
Colonel Rome looked like he was about to blush. You realize that you're the first person to gather both the support of the military and the Corvids. Stop. Just stop there. I don't need you blowing smoke up my ass. I get enough of that from Central. Rome toyed with a piece of loose metal that jutted from an overhanging mech arm. You know that whole riot thing was as much luck as skill. Some of those rioters were armed. If they'd fired one shot, it would have turned into a massacre. But it didn't, Blake felt like saying. And that's how heroes were born. It leads me to why I'm here. Finally. After that incident, people started to notice me. Long story short, I've had an audience with the great leader, and he wants me to take over as commander of District 4. Blake was taken aback. She knew he was a flyer, but to make general in your 30s, that was fast. And as I said, back at Central, I have a bunch of people buzzing about, blowing smoke up my ass. Those guys will lead me to the noose while telling me that it's a great idea and I thought of it myself. You understand? Blake understood perfectly. Her ears popped and she started to feel lightheaded. Rome went on. I'm going to need a staff colonel, one that's as straight as an arrow. I need someone that will tell me when to rein in my dumb ideas and when to go for it. You want me to be your advisor? Blake stated flatly. Rome nodded. When I look at your career, I don't see mediocrity. I see consistency. I'm this wild public figure, and I need you to knock me off my pedestal every now and again. Of course, you would move on to your own command after the initial posting. The last sentence, spoken almost as a throwaway line, ignited a fire inside Blake that she hadn't felt in years.
What do you say? Captain Blake did not hesitate. Yes, of course. What officer doesn't want to advance? It's what I've always wanted.
Rome smiled, not without warmth. I knew you'd be on board. Brace yourself, though, Edwina. I see big changes in the future. You see this? He gestured around them at all the junkers and ruined machinery Blake's forces had whittled down and torn apart over the years to keep themselves going. There'll be no more of this. I want reforms, building projects. We can bring in a new era of... Lieutenant Greer burst out of the door, urgency written into every aspect of his body language. He was currently Ops Room Commander, along with Major Trask, the second in command to Colonel Rome. Sorry to intrude, Colonel, he said without preamble, before addressing Blake. Ed, you're needed in the Ops Room, now!
Ready up! Ready up!
Kinney screwed up his eyes as the strip lights flickered on with a hum and cursed loudly.
I want those legs on the line in 3 minutes!
It had to happen. Kronig couldn't let them rest. Several more curses joined his in a chorus, and there was a general commotion as tired bodies dragged themselves from iron-framed beds. He hated being on QRF. He hated leaving his personal bed space to go sleep on these awful bunk beds with the green plastic mattresses. The whole platoon was crammed into one small room, and so many troops had passed through there that someone almost always caught scabies from the damn things. More than any of that, he hated Kronig's shout. It wasn't really a shout. His vocal cords were too damaged. It was just his regular growl, but amplified to the point where it grated the senses. Kinney had just managed to drop off to sleep, too. He rolled over and looked at his watch. 2 hours. It had been 2 hours since taking over from 2nd Platoon, and already the dickhead was running a crash-out drill. Couldn't he at least wait until first light? Kinney felt gloved hands grab his jacksuit and drag him off the bed. He half fell from the third bunk, but he blinked and Kronig was there, nose to nose, holding him upright. Get on the line, he said quietly, before releasing Kinney and pushing past, already zeroed in on Markovitch, who was scrambling to put his boots on. The veteran trooper wasn't too bright, but he had Jack compatibility and always re-upped his contract, so that was good enough for the army. Kinney wasn't dumb. He slept with his boots on during a QRF rotation, so he just staggered through the flimsy wooden door onto the garage floor. Rows of mogs filled the expansive space, with the Buckmaster scouts and the heavies off to one side. The QRF mogs were to the fore, cockpits open, kept on standby mode for the duration of the rotation. Kinney quickly identified M841 and made a beeline for it, then stopped. He looked across to the other end of the garages, where the human-sized doors connected them to the rest of the base, where Captain Blake was climbing the access ladder up the side of Eddie. The Toro-class heavy mech was an imposing sight, and Kinney did not expect to see it in action that night. Across from her, the visiting colonel climbed his own machine, the command variant, Wolfmother, and dropped out of sight through the top hatch. That wasn't normal. Officers rarely got involved in drills, and if they did, it was only in an observation role. What's going on? Kinney thought, as he climbed onto the stumpy access steps, one situated on the inside of each calf of his power suit. From here he leaned in and pulled the carbine from its rack, where it sat stowed to the rear right of his assault harness. It was a blocky piece of stamped metal with plastic furniture and a folding stock. It also had a ridiculous laser unit on top, which was supposed to be used for close-quarters warfare, but added so much weight as to make it useless. The grunts on base used it to disperse crowds in potential riot situations. After the Troubles, it became ingrained into the human psyche, somehow. If you see a red dot on you, you get out of there. A knot threatened to twist in his stomach as Kinney conducted routine ready-up checks, and he swallowed hard to push it down. It just felt wrong. He checked the mag was already fitted, racked the charging handle, put the fire selector to safe, and stowed the carbine away. Kinney then shrugged into his lightweight survival rig, which resembled a canvas vest, containing spare magazines for the carbine, a couple of grenades, water, a small med kit, and an escape map, should he become separated from his mog. Giving his torso a confirmatory wriggle to ensure the rig was comfy, he spun around in a practice motion, slotting his feet into the thigh sections of his suit, and leaned back. He reached behind him and found the jack, then slotted that into his cranial port. It started without warning, as always. The feeling of icy fingers prodding inside his flesh, creeping out from his neck and worming through the body until his extremities tingled uncomfortably. The private got goosebumps and shuddered. He never got used to that. The power plant kicked out of standby mode upon detection of a driver and rumbled softly with an energized hum that Kinney found soothing. Once connection was established, he pulled a clip from the rear of his jack suit, which extended on a tensile cord, and clamped it over the jack port. The last thing he needed was to become disconnected in the middle of contact, and the clip would ensure nothing short of emergency ejection would sever him from his mongoose. Next, Kinney clipped the leg and shoulder straps of his assault harness closed and clinched them up tight. Rumour had it that Kronig drove without straps to afford better manoeuvrability, but Kinney thought that would make it extremely tiring to drive, what with the slight lag between driver movement and that of the machine. Finally, to complete the seal, he reached up and pulled on the ram holding his canopy up, and it came down smoothly. Movement synchronised with the closing of the thigh plates. Once cocooned inside his power suit, Kinney squirmed around until he managed to slot his arms into armoured gauntlets and wrapped his hands around the trigger mechanism of his machine guns. Thumbing the top button of each gun, he was rewarded with the clack of full metal jacketed rounds being chambered. As soon as his weapons were ready, blurry white crosshairs appeared on his forward display, which darted about in sympathy with the motions of his arms. Kinney looked down and to his left. Every bulb on his diagnostic board displayed green. It was a rare occurrence, but one they had assured happened for the inspection. He was good to go. The whole process took no more than a couple of minutes. All around him, MOG drivers were readying up, reporting their status in clipped tones over the squad net. Kinney was first squad, so reported to Sergeant Kronig. The senior NCO was chief administrator and disciplinarian inside base, but on the ground, he was technically the equal of Anna Morante, commander of second squad. Three squads of five MOGs made up 1st Platoon, and their role was to protect the heavies from infantry and light armoured threats so that they were free to take out whatever objectives lay before them. Kinney waited his turn in the queue until he heard Bader ready up. "This is Kinney. Ready." Kronig grumbled a confirmation, then reported up the chain to the commander.
Mogs weren't important enough to warrant their own names, and individual call signs were unnecessary at the squad level, so Kronig permitted his troops to use their names on the net. It was less confusing that way.
"What's going on, Sarge?" crackled Mirante over the squad net.
"From what I can gather," Kronig returned, "there's been an unauthorized gate opening."
Shit, thought Kinney.
That was bad for the army. The gates were instrumental to Great Leader's power. Keeping separate elements of the Corvid masses apart was key to stopping them from rising up. Kinney wondered where his brother was.
"A garbled contact report was received from Hunter Team. They reported being under attack by armed civilians before the transmission cut off."
"Enemy numbers?"
That was Corporal Nito, commander of 3rd Squad. He rarely spoke, but when he did, it was usually important.
"Unknown, but the rest of the base is readying up in reserve to give us support if we need it."
"We get a grid from the contact report?"
Nito again.
"Roger, they were in the Blues, directly east of the district gate."
"That's rough terrain for heavies, narrow streets," Mirante said, and Kinney found himself nodding in agreement.
The standard patrol routes usually consisted of perimeter checks and curfew calls. They rarely ventured into the rat's maze of habitation blocks that made up the western portion of the sector.
"Well, it'll be us dragging them out of the shit if it goes off," Kronig rumbled.
"We aren't taking dismounts."
It was standard procedure to leave infantry behind if a platoon crashed on QRF. They couldn't keep up with the leg units on foot, and the transport trucks were too vulnerable.
"You better make sure your men are on point."
As soon as he finished, the ground rumbled noticeably, and ceiling fans chugged into action to extract waste emissions as the heavies powered up. Their shields were so powerful, Kinney could feel his teeth itch even inside his suit, and a barely perceptible buzz could be heard on the radio's carrier signal. He turned the MOG in place to watch as the slab-sided war gods stood up to their full height, accompanied by a groan of hydraulic pistons. Eddie was armed with a quad-barreled artillery piece that could flatten city blocks and decimate squadrons of tanks, and its armored prow could crush anything in its path. Even its secondary weapon, a kinetic laser affectionately known as the Bully, could turn lesser units into scrap in short order. They rarely got to patrol with heavy support, outside of tactical training. Kinney was still in awe every time he saw one in action. That's what it meant to be a career soldier, in his mind. If he re-upped, he could be piloting his own war mech in a few years. He dismissed the thought before it left him feeling confused again. He hoped that Carlos hadn't done anything stupid. Connection. Blake detected the distinct smell of ozone that accompanied Shields rising to full power as she settled into her command couch. The captain observed the multitude of displays available to her, and all seemed well. Hoppers and magazines were full, autoloaders well-oiled, and power plant was in the high 90s. The techs had done a good job. When she was satisfied, she opened up a comms channel to Wolfmother, currently standing across from her. The Colonel's mech was a command variant, a Praetor class, identified by the nest of antennas that sprouted from the upper carapace to the rear of the machine. It had an outlandish design stenciled across either side of its blunt visage, that of a snarling wolf's head in brilliant white paint. Only Rome could get away with that, she thought. He said that he would join her on the ground as her second. His mech was outfitted for direct fire, mounting a 105mm cannon and heavy machine gun for defence. So, theoretically, should be no different to working alongside Lieutenant Greer. He would complement her artillery, cooperating to bracket targets for destruction should the need arise.
"Are you sure about this, Colonel?" she asked. If this was going to get bad, and there was a good chance it might, she didn't want a future district commander getting killed on her watch.
"Stop worrying, Ed. I won't get in your way. Just treat me as you would your usual battle buddy. Besides, I won't be allowed to stomp concrete anymore after my promotion. There's a good chance I'll be piloting a desk after this outing." He had a point. Still, he had the worst possible timing. Why had he chosen today of all days to visit her sector? What if it all went to shit?
"Okay then," she said. "If you're certain, then we better get moving."
Blake flipped a switch on her console, and the huge garage doors began to open on rollers mounted from the ceiling. Huge concrete floor plates shuddered into life,
rotating the heavy mech to face the exit. As it rumbled slowly on great gears, the skyline of Solo Nobre came into view, all grim high-rise blocks and crumbling industrial machinery. There was a faint orange glow to the horizon, too bright to be cast by the magnesium bulbs of the street lamps. It appeared as though the city was burning. Blake was gripped by a cold chill, as though her mech had interpreted her emotional state and shivered in sympathy. "Eddie, this is Ops, over," came Lieutenant Greer's voice over the command net. "Go ahead, Ops," she responded, impatient to get going. Greer opened the line, but there was a definite pause before he spoke again. "It's the bulletin board network. There's something wrong with it." Blake had no time for vagaries, not now. "What's wrong with it? Are there any orders from district?" "Well, no, but the BBS seems to be corrupted somehow," he started, but Blake cut him off. "It can wait. Have you managed to get comms with Central yet?"
"Not yet. There's a lot of interference on all channels."
There was definitely something bigger than a simple error in gate scheduling going on. "Well, inform me via VHF as soon as you hear anything. We'll be setting relays as we go, so you should have no problem keeping comms with us. Eddie, out." She closed the link and switched over to the squad net. "All call signs, this is Eddie. We don't know what to expect out there, so be on your guard. Chances are there's been a gate malfunction and Corvid separatists are using the opportunity to cause some havoc. Nothing more." She stopped and considered her next words. "Regardless, this is just a patrol like any other. Remember your training and look to your NCOs for guidance. All leg call signs, move out."
"I want a standard phalanx formation. First squad on point, second left flank, third right, until we're out of cover range of the base."
Kronig's commands were clipped and spoken with a calm urgency born of years of experience. Reynolf Kinney barely heard the orders. He was too busy fixated on the captain's little speech. Real dread began to set in as he shuffled into position. "She's never done that before,"